Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi, the streaming online cinema. For your free 30-day trial of Mubi, go to mubi.com/filmstage.
We'll meet again. Don't know where. Don't know when. But I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the movie review podcast for thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me today, we have Michael Snydell.
Hello.
And Bill Graham. Yes, that, yeah, those are your names. Brian J. Rowan is my name. And here we are today to talk about the anime film that swept Japan in a fervor, and that is Your Name. Which apparently,
I think it's like
in a period.
I think it's fifth of all time, fifth highest box office of all time in Japan.
Yeah, it was a massive thing that everyone heard about last year, and it's now on the shores here in America. And so we are going to talk about it, especially because Bill, I believe you saw it, and we're like, holy crap, we got to talk about this.
Well, I had heard a lot about it, and look, I think anytime we can watch a animated film from Japan, it's probably a good choice. So, generally, they crank out some good stuff.
up for debate. We will talk about that more. However, before we get into that, I wanted to do all the stuff we usually do at the top of these episodes. First of all, follow us on Twitter @FilmStageShow. Follow us on Facebook, The Film Stage Show. Give us a comment and a rating on iTunes. And some people actually did that for us. One person apparently moved by my passive-aggressive comments asking for more just updated their review and gave us 5 stars, which was really nice of them.
And lovely then, human being.
Yeah. and then we had Rogue Knight, who gave us a 5-star review titled "Put Him in Spacesuits." that review said, "I only listen to a few podcasts, but TFSS is easily towards the top of my list. Not at the top, not one of the top, but towards the top," he says. Or she says. They go on, "The banter is fun, and the film..."
Brian might be insightful. In a shitty mood today, by the way, guys.
I may be. "While discussions over heady films are mentally stimulating, the Batman v Superman episode will always be my favorite due to the hyperbolic rhetoric on both sides of that one. Keep up the good work, fellas." I'm going to go on a limb and say that if this person's favorite episode is Batman v Superman, they won't mind a bit of the Brian Rowan fire today. So I'm going to keep it up. I'm going to keep that fire burning. I should also say that we are brought to you by Mubi, the streaming online cinema, where their curators hand select films to show on their service. The best thing about Mubi is that they have a constantly rotating selection of 30 films, so while you're always getting something new, you also have a manageable amount to pick from. They introduce a new film each day, and you have 30 days to watch, and then it disappears. But because they're constantly putting a new thing in, like I said, you always have 30 films to choose from. And how you watch them is also up to you. You can watch them on your mobile device, you can watch them on your computer, you can watch them on their beautiful Roku app, and you can download them to your mobile device so that you can watch on the go. So if you're looking for a great way to introduce yourself to some of the best of international, independent, and all-around wonderful cinema, Mubi is for you. Go to mubi.com/filmstage, and you will get a free 30-day trial of Mubi on us. So go and do that thing that I just said. Before we get into Your Name, we wanted to bring up the fact that yesterday the film world was shaken by the news that director Jonathan Demme had passed away. Demme was the director of such films as Silence of the Lambs, The Update of the Manchurian Candidate, and Philadelphia. And so we just wanted to give our quick reactions to that, because this is truly indeed a giant of cinema who has passed. So, Michael Snydell, you were the one who brought this news to my attention. What were your first thoughts when it happened?
Well, my first thoughts were that it's a terrible loss. I mean, Demi is someone who, you know, Silence of the Lambs was kind of a formative movie for me, but I don't think that I realized the things that Demi, you know, imbued in it to make it brilliant. Like in the last 6 months, I've actually watched both Something Wild and Stop Making Sense, which are two movies that a lot of people talk about in relation to him. And they're two of the most like joyful, empathetic film experiences I've ever had in my entire life. So to hear that he's passing really feels like we're losing a voice that was, you know, preternaturally sensitive to understanding so many different people from so many different walks of life. So he leaves behind a lot of great movies, and as perverse as it sounds, I'm excited to catch up on Blind Spots now. Like I have more motivation, as horrible as that sounds, but he left behind quite a legacy.
All right. Bill Graham, any thoughts that you had about this passing?
I mean, Jimmy's not someone that I really kind of explored as a filmmaker. Certainly Rachel Getting Married and Silence of the Lambs, I saw both of those films. Silence, I haven't visited in a while, but Rachel Getting Married, I remember having quite a lot of fond thoughts of how complicated and kind of nuanced that particular story is. And particularly Anne Hathaway, that was kind of a breakout role for her. So I mean, I enjoyed his work, but not the titan that a lot of people kind of, for me at least, he hasn't had that profound of an effect on me. So I think that's more of my shortcomings than his. So, but it is what it is.
Here's another question. Bill, are you eating something right now?
I'm chewing on something mildly.
what is happening over there? What are you chewing on?
It's some oatmeal.
So you were eating oatmeal?
Yeah.
While podcasting?
I was. Yeah, I was. Okay. I didn't realize it was that obvious.
I mean, it would only be more obvious if you literally put the microphone inside your mouth like you were David Yao.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
That's fine. Nick Newman used to make a thing out of, like, for the first part of an episode, like, eating a whole muffin. Go back in time, ladies and gentlemen. Listen to some of those episodes. And he would be very upfront about it, too. He'd be like, oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know you were going to call on me so soon. I'm still eating my muffin. And it's like, okay, great. as far as me and how I feel about Jonathan Demme, a lot of people were doing the Twitter/Facebook thing where it's like, oh, my God, this is such a loss for me. I haven't seen enough of his work, honestly.
Yep.
I feel like looking through his filmography, I've seen obviously The Silence of the Lambs. Is it? Yeah, it is The Silence of the Lambs. That's great. I actually got the article right.
What?
And I've seen The Manchurian Candidate. That is sort of it.
I think Stop Making Sense is actually on Amazon Prime. I believe that's where I watched it.
Yeah, and I mean, he's got a bunch of great looking stuff, and I just, I don't know. He's done music videos, he's done concert films, he had Justin Timberlake plus the Tennessee Kids.
Sure.
Which a lot of people were talking about last year.
And he also did some great TV work with the HBO show Enlightened, which I try to talk about anytime I get a chance, but he directed two fantastic episodes of that.
Yeah, he did Enlightened. He did some of The Killing. I mean, he's got a bunch of stuff, but for some reason, this is just one of those people that I never got into. So I'm a little bit, you know, I'm interested to go back and look, but I mean, it's awful to say this now that he's gone. But I just never felt the need or the desire to go back through his filmography. The Silence of the Lambs is obviously great, but I remember being like so put off by his remake of The Manchurian Candidate that I just kind of I didn't really feel like going back and looking. But in the
I was a fan of that one, as I talked about in an episode, you know, in the last 6 weeks or so.
Yeah. I mean, you're weird. That's fine. But I really should. I need to go back. I need to see things like Philadelphia. I need to see things like Rachel Getting Married, which people have been talking about a lot. So I'm using this as an unfortunate opportunity to posthumously get into his work and see some of the things that people said are worthy. So I will be doing that probably. But I mean, it's a tragedy anytime anyone passes away in this world, obviously. And part of me now is like, man, I really hope I don't watch some of his other stuff and like get it now, and then I'm gonna have to feel bad in retroactively.
I mean, that would be the best scenario, wouldn't they? Wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, like technically, but then I'm gonna be like a month behind the grief swing. You know, everyone's gonna have moved on to whoever passed away next, and I'm just gonna like burst onto Twitter screaming, "Oh my god, guys! Did you know this guy's amazing?" So we'll see. We'll have to see about that. It's we live in a weird time because there, you know, even 10 years ago, something like Jonathan Demme passing would have been obviously an event, but it wouldn't have been as universal an event. I think back to like when Johnny Cash passed away, and for like weeks afterward, I would make mention of the fact that Johnny Cash had died, and people would be like, "He didn't die," and then we'd have to like go find a computer somewhere, and then I would have to look it up to prove to them. And we don't live in that time anymore. Things are very immediate, so I almost feel bad that like I didn't keep up with his work so I could more fully invest in this, you know, public grieving process that we've started to normalize. So
I had a similar experience with James Earl Jones, who I told a friend was being cast in the live action remake or reboot of Lion King. And they were like, "What? James Earl Jones is dead." I was just like, you give me 1 second. Give me 1 second. Let me go turn to this thing called the cell phone and I'm going to prove you wrong. And I was like, not only is he constantly on the Arby's commercials, but he is very much alive.
No, yeah, I mean, it's weird how back in the day, like, that was a question that people would ask, and you had to, like, think for a minute about it. No more. James Earl Jones, I'm not going to look up how old he is. Before the episode started, we started looking up other directors to see, like...
Because I was getting worried.
Yeah, because Jonathan Demme was 73 when he passed away, and then we found out that Martin Scorsese and Terrence Malick are both older than him. So now everyone's panicking, and no one is happy. So let's move on.
I'm fine.
Bill's fine. Bill will care when Guillermo del Toro passes away.
This is true.
That's a reference to a previous episode of the Film Stage Roundtable.
Go
check that out. Let's move on. Let's talk about Your Name. This is the new film from Makoto Shinkai, I believe is how you pronounce that. If it is not, I apologize profusely. I haven't figured out how to do a synopsis for this.
I don't know either, to be honest with you. One thing I do want to mention is I went into this film, I don't know about y'all, I went into this film basically based on the praise and how well it had done at the box office. That was pretty much everything that I knew about this film. I had heard that this director had a lot of interesting stuff. I had heard that the film was beautiful. Beyond that, I did not know much about it. So I went in pretty darn blind.
I made sure to watch one other film by him.
I did not. Let's just do the thing that we sometimes do. So just a quick yes or no. Should people go see this film? Bill Graham.
Absolutely.
All right. Michael Snydell.
Yes, B minus.
And for me, I'm going to say...
No. Okay.
So that's our thoughts as far as that.
Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
I don't have a trailer because the past has taught me that playing trailers for foreign films.
There's just, a dub, Brian.
I didn't want to do that. We didn't watch the dub, and I didn't fucking feel like it. So there will be no trailer.
Down with dubs.
There will be no trailer. So we're just going to get into it. Let's talk about Your Name. Now that we've just given our quick yes or no, I guess we can say glancingly, this movie is about a young man and a young woman who randomly swap bodies.
Mm-hmm. Sort of.
Sort of. Yeah. There are various mechanics that go into that, but that's the basics that we need to talk about it in general. And we will have a spoiler section, so you can look forward to that. And I'm pretty sure that we're going to get into the spoiler section fairly quickly. So
yeah.
Let's just give our general all-around thoughts right now. Bill Graham.
Sure. I'm the one that got us into this mess. And I will mention before we kind of get into the review, we've had a nightmare scenario with the screener situation.
Oh,
so that's very unfortunate. I think it's probably unintentionally going to pepper this review a little bit because
I don't think it. Okay, so maybe, but probably not for me. Just because it's not the movie's fault that the studio that's distributing it in America chose the worst screening service possible. And once I actually got the film to play, it was like beautiful and had no problems and everything was fine. So it's as though I just like happened to go to like 7 sold out screenings before I was finally able to get in. So I won't blame the movie for that.
I did not have that experience. I had multiple times had to pause in the middle of the experience, especially in the last hour. So there's definitely, if some of my thoughts make it sound like the second half is more disconnected, I mean, I need to say that up front that my legitimate experience was more fractured and fragmented than I would like.
Okay. All right. Well,
kind of like the movie.
Yeah. Let's talk about the film as a narrative piece of art. So Bill Graham, what did you think about this?
So again, I went in pretty darn blind. I knew there was some aspect of romance to the film, but I really didn't know much beyond that. And I was really struck by just the beauty of the animation and the way it's weird to me because animation. I mean, we all know animation has a tendency to kind of, especially for backgrounds. For whatever reason, when they really kind of nail the feeling more than just the look, but the feeling of like our current reality and things like that, it's oddly beautiful. When if a film was set in that, nobody would say anything about it. Like nobody would be like, "Oh, hey, that was a beautiful film." No, it would just be set in New York or something like that. But for whatever reason, animation, when it really kind of nails the feeling of a location, the feeling of kind of being a big city versus a small city, which kind of comes into play in this film. I really think this film kind of nails that feeling, and there's just a beauty to it. That is, you know, seeing it on the big screen was quite a pleasure. It starts off in a very hilarious way. It takes advantage of the body swap kind of narrative, and it really kind of runs with it. And it does interesting things with it. In terms of gender swapping, but also like just kind of the sweetness of it. It doesn't turn it into kind of this kooky, crazy thing. It doesn't get gross with it. It's really kind of respectful. And I like the way that it kind of has this own built-in narrative of how the characters kind of evolve and how we kind of are given information slowly as the characters are kind of starting to really put things together. it sets it up pretty early that they kind of forget who each other are and the fact that they even are swapping bodies. And so it's up to like pieces of technology and things like that to kind of keep track of that. And so I think that is a very, very interesting kind of tweak on the idea, how it plays out and things like that. I just really, really enjoyed this film. It's rated PG-13 over here. I think that it kind of scoots by. Yeah, really? I know. Yeah, I think it kind of scoots by with that. I think it probably should be PG-13. But
wait,
regardless,
it's rated PG here.
Yeah, that's what I said.
Michael, did he say PG or PG-13?
I thought I heard PG-13 too, but I'm not sure. I could see it being PG-13 for one thing. That's a
PG-13.
No, for one repeated joke, I can
PG-13. Yeah, and that's what I was kind of leaning towards. Either way,
yeah, I can. I mean, yeah, we have a very puritanical society here, so I think that might be true. But I think PG fits it better, and it makes more sense to me.
Yeah,
I'll listen in playback.
Yeah. It is interesting though, the kind of stylistic choices and the kind of comic sensibilities that it kind of takes. And I just, like I said, I just really, really enjoyed this. I think this is a very mature piece of work, that has a lot to say about kind of playing with that genre. I think it does play a little fast and loose with some things, but the first half is kind of light and airy, and by the second half I was just completely invested. So
all right, Michael Snydell, what did you think of Your Name period?
Well, like, so as a brief prelude, I've kind of heard Shinkai's name for a while from friends who are, I fell off anime a long time ago, but I've heard his name tossed around a lot. And even one of his earlier, or perhaps his most well-known film, 5 Centimeters Per Second, actually ended up on the film stage best animated films of the 21st century, that list that I believe was last year now. So he's definitely someone who has a lot of acclaim in in certain groups, and especially among people who are into contemporary, you know, anime auteurs, directors, whatever you want to do. So what I will say is that Your Name is a very strange case in the sense of, I think it's almost disingenuous to say that it's airy in the first half and it changes in the second half, because this feels like a film that after the hour and 10 mark, it just keeps going and going and going. And I like a lot of the things that are being discussed in the first half, in the way that, like, you have two characters who are coming from two disparate cultures, and you know how those cultures as well view the roles of men and women, and how it delves into the body swap stuff in that case. And like, it's kind of, I guess it has to be said that Shinkai has been kind of unfairly compared to Miyazaki and Takahata and, like, you know, Ghibli people. But I do think in this one there is at least a kinship, in the sense that Shinkai also seems very interested in how humans, like, their relationship to, like, the natural order. And so I really like that stuff in the first half, and I think the characterization is good for the most part. I think this is a movie that's very heavy on narration. And I think you're either going to like that or dislike it. And it's narration that kind of gets into, like, very philosophical, verbose, stuff that doesn't really necessarily tell you things about character, but, like, is trying to almost, you know, imbue, like, a mythic sense into the movie. And so I guess the thing is, like, I just don't I don't really know what this movie's trying to do after in the third act and what it's actually interested in, because it seems like it wants to be wants to focus on two very different things, in the sense of in the first half being based on like these very Japanese ideas of tradition and you know, city rural spaces, but then in the second half it seems to want to be this, you know, cosmic love story that wants to be very personal and make like every moment just this this cosmic melodrama, and it's just, I don't know what it's, I don't know what it's doing, and it's hard for me to take the second half at face value when it's just it's trying so hard for these lofty themes, and it just doesn't really feel like it's actually building on anything that it's leading towards in the first half. Like Bill said, this is gorgeous. I did a tiny bit of research. Apparently what they did is the backgrounds are hand-drawn and then scanned and then digitally augmented and colored, which is how they have this shimmering like photorealism to them. It's like incredible. Like in any given scene, like you'll see, for instance, like a moped and just like this level of texture and detail and like depth of perspective that is just I really do wish I got to see this on a big screen. I find this interesting, but I'm still just kind of baffled by it.
Oh, go ahead.
I know that's a good place to end, honestly, because okay. Then I can get into stuff later.
Yeah. The movie is beautiful. I think that the artwork is great. You know, usually my problem with anime is that, like, you'll have a scene where, like, people are talking and it's focusing on, like, a static shot of, like, a cigarette in an ashtray, and it's because it's all a cost-saving measure. And then when people are speaking, they're, like, you know, eyes closed, head down, mouth moving, but like the other person in the background is stock still. And obviously cost saving measures, not a problem for this movie. This movie has, you know, very fluid, very beautiful animation in that way. So my usual aesthetic complaints with anime are gone. And it's to the point where it's like calling this an anime feels like a disservice, because some of those quote-unquote cost-saving measures are used stylistically in anime to great effect, and this being as fluid as it is, you know.
Can you speak of something specific? I kind of know what you're saying, but can you give like a specific example
in of what,
of something that you think of an anime example that uses those cost-saving measures as a like aesthetic touch?
Like Neon Genesis Evangelion.
Okay.
I recently watched the first season of Psycho Pass with my wife because she likes it, and it's actually a really good show. But it will do things like that. The other thing is that, you know, some anime has begun to augment itself. Or I guess it hasn't begun. It's probably been happening for a while. But it augments itself with CGI and other various forms of new animation. And this one seems to as well, but it's a lot better integrated. As much as I loved Psycho Pass, there were times when it would stick to a CGI creation, and it was fairly obvious.
The sky looks incredible in this movie.
Like, yeah. this movie, I can't remember the name of it. Mushi, maybe, I feel like was the name of it. Oh, Mushishi. It was a show that a friend of mine who was into anime told me about a while ago, and he made me watch a couple episodes, and it was probably the best anime representation of nature. I think that this one comes very close, but Mushishi might still win.
I do think one careful distinction should be made is that you're talking mainly about series that have this kind of repetition, which is you know, like you watch an American television versus like a epic like Silence, and you know they're night and day difference,
yes,
both in
but at the same
you know
time, like American television shows, and this is something that's we're not talking about on this episode, but sure. I will bring up briefly. American TV is chasing down American cinema. You look at things like Mad
sure.
Men, Better
it's
Call Saul,
close.
Breaking Bad. Yeah, they're gunning for it. Westworld, I think, is the closest we've gotten. But yeah, I mean, yes, that is true. That the TV shows, but that's what I'm talking about. Like, anime is given a certain cachet because most of what anime people know is through television shows, things like that happened on Toonami back in the Cartoon mm-hmm. Network days. This still has the characters who have the wide eyes and the vaguely, I don't know, there's no good way to say this, the vaguely Caucasian look to them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, yeah. I mean, that's fair, and that's something that definitely Japan has struggled with is how much they kind of take on the Western kind of identity and the look and the feel of the people. They're usually
yeah.
very pale, and
which I'm fine with. I'm just saying, like, if you hear the word anime and immediately think, "Ooh, no, I'm not watching," you know, someone with their eyes closed and their face half covered talk about something for
sure,
30
sure.
seconds while nothing moves in the background. This is a lush, gorgeous, you know, early era of Disney-esque kind of thing. There mm-hmm. are, and mm-hmm. I say this in the best way possible, there are things in here that remind me of, like, Snow White and Bambi.
Uh-huh.
Which again is a good thing. My problems.
But there's still like, wait, there's still like a lot of contemporary anime that is on this level just aesthetically
yes, I'm
different.
Just saying, like
something like Red Turtle last year.
Yeah. But again, if you hear anime, again, if you listening at home hear anime and think Sailor Moon or Dragon Ball Z, we're not talking about that. Like, I'm trying to give examples that someone who's not familiar with anime like the Red Turtle would be able to understand.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I just don't want you to
No, I'm
I
not
do
writing
see
off
what
the
Brian,
entirety of it. No.
I do see what Bill was trying to warn against when he was saying that you're comparing it to television shows. Like, it gets a little bit iffy when we start switching mediums. And I recognize that, like, anime is something that has, like, very specific touchstones
yeah.
for many
most
people.
Of the United States, yeah, they would hear anime and not think of this movie. It is funny, though, because this does have one anime touchstone. And that is an opening credit sequence set to a pop song that is very impressionistic.
Very catchy.
Yeah.
Very
super catchy,
catchy
song. Now, where my problems come in, because obviously aesthetically I am very much on this movie's wavelength, is the story. We'll get into it more in spoilers, but suffice to say for now, I don't know that the story 100% holds together, and I don't know that I was able to track the emotional path of this film because of that. And I feel like after a certain revelation is met, the movie shifts its narrative purpose pretty dramatically
yep.
and never fully recovers. And then when it tries to recover, it takes too long to recover. So there's a couple of emotional turns that I don't buy. And then there's a couple of narrative turns that I was not on board for. And then the ending itself is fine, but I feel like it wasn't what we appeared to be moving towards for perhaps 90% of the movie.
Sure.
So
I, to give
general,
a tease too, like the back half of this movie has a similar or strong similarities to a movie from last year.
Interesting. I was thinking of a movie from many years ago. We'll have to get into that in spoilers.
All right.
So yeah, I mean, it's funny because for the first while in this movie, I was like on board sort of because it was kind of a goofy, fun thing, but that still had some questions behind it, and it was making me ask questions that it turns out that the movie was completely disinterested in, and then it moves into something else completely, and I was not lost because the change in the narrative is very bold and very obvious, and so I knew exactly what was going on. I'm just not sure why it was going on in that way. And then the way it ends doesn't feel like it syncs up with anything except perhaps like one or two scenes scattered in the middle. So it doesn't feel like it moved there organically.
I will say one thing, that this ending is almost an exact echo of the ending of the other movie I saw by him, which I've heard some people critique that, like, this movie begins as something very different from what he usually does, which in my limited experience I agree with, and goes back to a lot of his pet themes.
What's funny for me is that this movie ends almost in exactly the same way as a short story that I wrote in my junior year of high school.
We're just all over the place, right?
To the point where I was like, holy shit, that's a little startling. But anyway, let's wrap this up and move into spoilers.
Vagaries. Holy shit.
So what we have, I'm just going to run through the whole plot, and then we can talk about it.
Bill, do you think we're missing anything else without specifically talking about spoilers?
No, it's incredibly difficult to talk about this film without talking about it in too much detail, because honestly, any kind of critique that you can level at it, it would just be insanely vague. as we've already established, this film is beautiful. So the aesthetics and kind of the way it looks and feels and moves, that's kind of already given two thumbs up by both of us, or all three of us. So it's like, okay, we can't touch on that. We can only touch on story details from this point on, and anything specific would be a spoiler. So
yeah, because
we can move right into it.
Even if I were to say, you know, the central romance makes literally no sense to me, we couldn't argue in either direction without talking about it.
Sure.
Okay, so spoilers for Your Name. Spoilers. His name is Taki, and her name is Mitsuya. Yeah. No.
Well played.
Your name is Michael. So, spoilers. So what happens is, and this is unfortunately going to sync up with one of my first issues, it appears at first that we're supposed to believe that both of these people think that they are simply dreaming being a different person.
No,
but it works as, but they imagine, like, their sensation, the way they describe it is like a dream, but I got it that they do switch bodies, but just the sensation, like, which is kind of like visualized in, I'm going to say exactly about the hour mark is where it takes on that new animation style. Is that, would you guys say that's right? About an hour in?
I'm not sure what you're talking about.
I'm not 100%
the sequence that is animated in a different way.
We're like in spoilers. You can say like this: the point when he falls down in the cave.
Okay, fine. Yeah, that's right. The point when he falls down in the cave. Like, yeah, I got that. It wasn't actually a dream. I just that.
It took you that long.
Sensation. No. That's I'm trying to rebuttal.
I'm
trying to reach Brian's point.
The reason that I ask is because I guess we should say their character names, though it's going to be difficult.
Matsuya and Taki.
Yeah, no, I'm talking about what I'm about to say now, which is Mitsuya in Taki's body is sitting with Taki's friends and is eating and says, oh, well, it's just a dream anyway. And then says, this is the best dream ever. And then, so like, she is living this man's life for him. And still seems to believe that it is a dream. And then there is a point at which they both seem to realize, oh my God, I'm not having dreams. I'm literally taking over someone's body.
Sure.
It plays fast and loose with this kind of setup, because like I mentioned when I kind of opened up, is what it does is it basically acts like they keep forgetting that they're doing this stuff. But as we learn, they're very much aware that they're interacting with someone else's body and they're living someone else's life, to the point where Mitsuya has been making notes inside of his like phone as diary entries and telling him what he did that day, telling her what they did that day.
They work and, up a system where they like start leaving each other diary messages to be like, hey, bro, I got you a date with that girl you have a crush on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it kind of plays fast and loose with that, because it's like, okay, at what point in the day do they start to remember that I'm actually living in someone else's life that is so important that I should probably start making diary entries and just letting them know, hey, this is what I did in your body this day.
And that's pretty basic, though. I actually really like that, like, it, you know, like it's feeling that they don't have to like specifically delineate it. Like that fast and loose thing you're talking about, Bill, I think that works really well for the pacing, which I know you're not saying it doesn't work, but I'm just saying I think them being a lot more loose with that like gives this a much different feel when it could feel kind of stodgy, you know, with
the
very premise.
Well, my issue is, you know, so they start switching lives, and there's no rhyme or reason to why and when it happens. I guess why is
as they say themselves in the middle of the movie, they switch randomly throughout the week, like few days.
Now, this is a question that I just need a very quick yes or no for, because it doesn't really affect my read of the film, but I'm still curious. Are they do they swap concurrently? Like, so when he's in her body, is she in his body?
Okay. Yeah. Yes.
Just making sure.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing is,
that's not totally clear, though. I don't blame you, Franz.
No, I don't think this is a sunken place kind of situation.
Well, sure. that question itself becomes more complicated when we realize that she is actually 3 years in the past in a village that is about to be wiped out by a meteor.
This is just straight up Lake House.
Yeah. It's my wife who watched this with me said, oh, so this is like the Lake House, but without Keanu Reeves, which makes it a worse movie.
Oh, Jesus.
She loves Keanu Reeves. We should all love Keanu Reeves. But yeah, so I just wanted to know. And so they appear to be moving on a parallel timeline, because she mentions something about the comet coming. He apparently doesn't think about it at all. He is aware that the comet is coming on a certain day for her, and then after that day, he can't get in touch with her because she is dead.
One thing I kind of started to piece together that they were probably in different timelines. And one thing that I was really curious to note was I was thinking that she was in a very older timeline at first. And then I started to realize how she kind of interacts with him using the technology and stuff like that. And I'm like, I never put together that it happened like 3 years in the past. And so I was thinking that they were swapping bodies and they were like 20 years apart or something like that. But her reaction to current technology would have been just this overblown thing. Like, whoa, this is crazy. Yeah, like, you have a cell phone. Like, what is this?
She can just chalk it up to like, oh, wow, these city folk have a lot more stuff than us.
Sure.
Yeah, it's that rural and city setting really masks what's actually going on there.
Yeah. And so I thought it was going to be kind of a 20-year jump. And when it ended up being 3 years, for me, like, I'm just as devastated as the character, because I'm like, whoa, that's like not that far away, and yet they could have interacted.
Well,
they could have, ultimately
she was.
Sure. And so, you know, it's like that, I think, carries a lot more weight when I was kind of figuring it out and then misjudged how much time was between them. Because if it was like 20 years, it'd be like, okay, yeah, y'all can meet now, but that's going to be weird.
I mean, I don't know what their exact ages are. It could still be a little weird.
Sure.
Can we just speak for a second, too, that like the moment Taki finds out, like, I have to give this movie credit. That is a really bold moment how they do that. Like, of having it be so mundane and then it becoming almost like a procedural for like the next 10 minutes and folding in characters from earlier. Like there is something really interesting and like clever about that,
sort of for me too, Michael, because when Michael, why did I call you Michael? apparently I'm going back to using like four different names for you. So what I was going to say is, so they have this back and forth, and they kind of forget about each other, but they also, the more they, the like when they accept what their situation is, they seem to like more remember each other, to the point where this boy, sure, Taki, falls in love with this girl. And what struck me as strange is that I was almost certain that she, Mitsuha, was falling in love with the girl that he had a crush on, his body.
Like, yeah.
She's like crying when she thinks about the fact that like he gets to go on his date and she's not going to be in his body. I was like, oh, cause she is falling in love with this girl. Isn't that interesting how like they're going to go into this concept of if you're in a different body, if you're living a different life, like, you know, does that, like, what does that say about the spectrum of human sexuality and the difference between your mind and what your body is telling you to do and all this other stuff? And instead, apparently, she's just sad that she's not going to be able to help him, or that he's going on a date with someone else that she helped him to hook up with.
I thought she wanted to eat at that place too.
That's also possible.
I think there's a complicated situation there, and I think part of it is because she's kind of, look, like, let's be honest here. When Taki has that situation kind of rise up for him, he's kind of startled. He's like, wait, what? Like, what did I do? And he's like, because he's kind of helpless with the ladies. And so I feel like she's crying because A, she put this guy in this weird situation where all of a sudden he's on a date with her and he's not the one that initiated it. He's not the one that really kind of followed through with it. He's not the one that was good and got her attention. So now he's put in this really awkward position of being on a date with a woman that he's attracted to, but wasn't the one that actually set him up in his own damn body. Like, can you imagine putting someone else in that position and being responsible for it? Like, that that's kind of like
to.
Like, it's kind of, it kind of sucks. I she didn't have to what?
She, like, they could have literally told each other, like, when you get in my body, you call in sick, okay? You stay home.
Sure.
You don't touch my life, asshole. But instead, they're kind of cool with, like, you know, go to school, I guess. Yeah, but like, sure, don't touch my breasts.
Well, I think, again,
don't do anything weird.
I think it also, this film again plays fast and loose with the whole idea of the body swap, and at what point do they kind of realize they are swapping bodies? At what point do they realize that this is actually having an effect on people? And I think towards the middle of the movie, you're right. You're supposed to kind of get the idea that they're becoming closer to understanding what they're actually doing.
See, it's almost
like they're coming out of a stupor or like a drunken haze each morning, and they're slowly figuring out things that they did, whether they're talking to their friends or stuff like that, and they're slowly piecing it together. I think
there's a lot of interesting stuff that's like that. Like when she says, like, why did a girl come up and profess her love to me? And he's like, I guess I know you're just cooler when I'm in you. Like, I'm more awesome than you are.
It's like a tweak of
basketball without a bra.
It's like a tweak of every scene in a body swap comedy. You know, like a Freaky Friday is the one that's coming to my mind right now.
Yeah.
But you know that scene where they're doing something. Like, I think there's a scene where Jamie Lee Curtis like wears a tank top that is not what the mother would wear at all. And you know, like, it does that exactly. It does that, and like it brings it to almost like an existential level, like saying that, look who you could be.
Yeah, and the best part is that because it's random, they are taking over their own life, and then like there's another point where someone's going to take it over again. So it's not like most body swap comedies where it's like, you gotta like get me back on the cheerleading team, and then I can go back into my body, and everything will be as it was, but we'll have a better understanding of each other. This is a movie that's like, you might have a better understanding of yourself. But my issue is, So yeah, like you said, Bill, and I guess we're just gonna have to chalk up a lot of this to that. They play fast and loose with the rules. They don't, you know, these, he goes to call her on his cell phone because he knows who she is, even after spending a whole day with someone else and not being in her body. I like,
but those rules get really, really complicated as the movie goes on.
Yes. And what I was going to say is, after he discovers that her town was wiped out, I really wanted the movie to just stay there. I wanted her to be gone. I wanted him to be dealing with these questions of, like, what the hell is happening? I didn't like the fact that, like, suddenly his cell phone just, like, deleted everything.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, like, I would love it if those things stayed, but, like, he had to wrestle with this concept of, like, but that's impossible. And if I can't even prove it by bringing her here, and if she's been dead for 3 years and this has been happening to me for 6 months, like, what is this? And what does it say about me? And then just have him, like, have to deal with that sadness and loss and not knowing what the hell's going on in his life for the rest of his life. But I'm a dark man. And
but that's also just so weird pacing wise after an hour.
Yeah.
Plus, like that weird thing where, you know, we're seeing every single day and then we're just supposed to get that, okay, 6 months passed. Like, it reminded me of, like, Wong Kar-wai, like Chungking Express.
Yeah.
But it's nowhere near as, like, precise in the way that it shows that.
And that's because they skip through the getting to know you section. Like, there's the getting to understand what's happening section, and then they kind of get to know each other, but that section feels super compressed so that they can get then jump into this weird,
like, second narrative.
Yeah, like, oh, we gotta save the city from a meteor. And it's like, wait, what? And then that is mixed in with him going to the shrine where he drinks some of her sake, which is gross. and then they're, like, standing on this caldera and talking to each other in the twilight, which, you know, that's a decent callback. But then, again, like, they keep forgetting each other, and I'm not sure why that's happening now. Like, I'm not sure what the shift is that takes him from, I know who this girl is and I like her and I'd rather try to call her on the phone now than pursue this other girl, and now I'm gonna go look for her. And then suddenly, like, he's like, oh man, I can't even remember her name, even though he, like, went and looked it up in a library and found it and was like, oh my god, that's her.
But he did have to see the name before he recognized it. So he didn't actually look it up in a library. He was just looking through the names, and he recognized two of her best friends, right? And then he looked down from that and then recognized her name.
Yeah, but I mean, I just don't understand.
I thought that was kind of
that is a solid point, but I'm not sure why he started forgetting to begin with. And I think
part of it has to do with the fact that she was dead. Like,
but
she's been dead
the whole time.
Yeah.
I know, but that's part of it, is because in his timeline it's coming back on the anniversary of it, if I'm not mistaken. And so it's been like the 3 year anniversary. And I think what we're supposed to kind of believe is, for whatever reason, this has happened, right? It doesn't explain any of that, and sure. I don't really need a lot of that explained. But for the last six months or so, this has been happening, and I think what it's building up to is him figuring out the timeline and being able to shift back into her body and potentially have enough time—a couple of days, maybe even a day or two. I can't remember how much time he actually has, but it's not very long. I think it's like half a day, to basically change the course of history and figure out how to get these people rescued.
Yeah,
her among them.
Didn't like that.
But yeah, I think I
really enjoyed that because of the fact that it played fast and loose, and I was just kind of in for the ride. I really enjoyed these two characters. I thought they were super, super fucking wholesome. Like, we don't get very many characters like this, like, that are just—
That's just very Japanese, man, though, too, Bill.
It is, but I'm just
Bill,
like,
you
man,
said, like,
like,
he's not good with the ladies, and I wanted to say, welcome to an anime protagonist.
Yeah, sure. But that is funny. You know, I think one of the reasons I enjoyed it so much, Brian, is one of the things that you kind of touched on was when they swap, it turns out they're better at being the opposite gender than they are at being their own gender, right? For whatever reason. It's like, you know, Mitsuha is raking in with the ladies, and then Taki's, you know, having women of the – or, you know, people of the same sex basically hitting on her at that point. Sure. You know, like doing something right.
And that was the weird thing is that, like, I really thought that it was going to go to a place where, like – I was shocked when it was oh, we love each other. And I was like, wait, what?
They almost do that in Taki's timeline too, where one of his friends is like, oh, he was cute yesterday. And maybe that's just a translation thing, but that was still something that, like,
sure,
there's that fluidity.
Yeah.
No, and,
they kind of disengage with that.
When he says, oh, he was cute yesterday, it got a laugh out of my crowd. Like it was definitely played for a joke in that situation. Cause even his friend like looks at him really weird. Like what?
Yeah. But
what,
I mean,
what'd you just say?
It's quite obviously a joke, but I'm curious as to
whether it was intentional callback to.
Yeah. I was curious as whether
or parallel.
Like, yesterday he was acting like a little girl or yesterday he was attractive to me.
Yeah,
I think
it was more attractive to me.
Yeah, it's possible.
That's the way I took it.
I guess the other thing I would say about the third act is like it is the things you mentioned, Bill, in the sense that like they go back into their own body and like there is long periods of time where new wrinkles seem to be added. But it's less that than like. Visually, like there are new visual techniques in that third act that have never been in the rest of the movie and make it feel far more, you know, dizzying and like impressionistic. And like it's interesting to watch, but I was losing track, especially in a movie that's been all about body swapping, who we were actually watching and what their motivation was at that exact moment, especially as it starts switching pretty aggressively back and forth between Taki and Mitsuha as they're trying to do separate things even before they come together on the top of, you know, that crater ridge. Like there's so much going on in that last 30 minutes.
I think there's a lot going on, but for me, I was able to track it pretty well. I think part of it may kind of ultimately sadly be because of the screener situation, but I think the other detail as well may be because I saw it on the big screen. And you know, a lot of times there's just little subtle things. I'm thinking of a movie like Enemy, where if you see it up on a big screen and you see it in a large format, it's easy to catch little subtle tones that the director intentionally adds into the way people kind of posture themselves, the way people move, things like that. It's easier to cue in on that. And I think something like that.
Because I saw Enemy on my laptop in a screener situation. I saw your name on my 50-something inch TV. But I was able to easily follow Enemy. I don't feel like I missed anything in your name. Like a lot of my issues really do just come down to I don't jive with the turn in the story. Like when it suddenly becomes like a child caper to try to save the town, I was like deeply disinterested.
That's kind of where it shot up for me. Like I was really interested in the first half and the setup and the execution of that. But by the end of it, I was just invested in these two characters and I was interested to kind of follow them through that journey.
No, I like he goes to the shrine and drinks the thing and then falls through time and then she's like running around. Or he becomes her and then is like setting up this plan to like save the town by blowing up a power station and hijacking the intercom. And I was like, wow, I really don't give a shit about any of this. Like there was something to the idea of him being connected to this vanished town that he had never heard of, that was destroyed I got this. I have this weird interest in ghost towns, especially ones that like were covered up by dams. I really like missing places like that. So the concept of, I can't remember the name of the town in this movie. But the concept of that and him becoming obsessed with that because of his otherworldly connection with this girl was deeply interesting to me. And then they changed it and they turned it into this thing where it's like, if we just set some explosives and you stand up to your dad, then we can win and save everyone. And
the town name is Itomori.
Yeah. They save Itomori, and then it's like, okay, great. So she's still alive. So now they can get together, but it's then 5 years in the future for him from his point, which means it's 8 years in the future for her and her point. And there's like this weird, like, I don't know how long it was actually, but it felt like a good 10 to 20 minutes of them like sort of missing each other and still feeling that same disaffection that they felt at the beginning. And I was like, you know, just like I was already invested in their meeting before I found out that she was 3 years in the past. And then you made me sit through this weird thing where they're trying to stop the town from being destroyed by a comet. And really, just saying they're trying to save the town from being destroyed by a comet, if you have like a cosmic destructive event that kills everyone that you don't see but is in the past, it's kind of a mythic thing. But when they make it this caper plot, it becomes sort of a farce.
It's not really a caper plot, though. I don't think that's fair.
I feel like it is.
Honestly. Like even when she trips, like it's juxtaposed with this kind of like harrowing image of the town exploding. Like it's there are a number of moments that remind you of the urgency of that. You know, whether it's her confronting her father or. The way how when she's talking, and not only that, but it like it does. See, as I talk about this more, like the weird thing about this is like this movie is in the first half. Like these characters are there. Like it might not be necessarily what I want, but it's Brent. I have to say the exact sensation you're talking about was the exact experience I had with Arrival, which I think this film has a lot in common with. Although I will say that Arrival is far more clean in the way that it switches. But that switch that you're talking about where you're saying that where it seems to be about one thing, like I in the case of Arrival, I liked that it was about this like very comprehensive, meticulous look into like cryptology, is that what I mean? Yeah, into cryptology and alien languages. And then it became a story that was extremely personal and didn't turn out to be interested in that stuff.
But like,
the
threat of language was through the whole thing of Arrival, and it folded the language into that personal story to give reason for everything.
But that is threaded in here. I don't think. And I will say, even being mixed on Arrival, I don't think that the threads are as cohesive here. But I can't say that they get nice. But I will say they do exist. Like they are in that first half. Like I mean, I think I'd be more willing to see specifically why you'd have a problem with that if you said the love story wasn't believable or something. Like, no, you didn't.
Yeah, I did.
Did he say that, Bill?
I don't understand why
these people are in love. I honestly thought she was falling in love with the other girl. I don't understand how much they can know each other if they seem to forget. And then, yeah, I even said it when I said, like, that the time jump, the getting to know you time jump, is too fast. That montage of 6 months isn't enough for us to get that they're falling in love with each other. Like they seem to have a little needly relationship going on, but for him to
I didn't get the sense that was you saying that they didn't seem convincing. That was just a pacing problem for me.
It's a pacing problem, but it also
yeah that
the issue with it being a pacing problem is that that's the point at which you're going to sell that relationship to me. But I mean,
okay.
if I feel like if I say, I swear to God, I thought she was falling in love with the other girl, that would be a hint that I didn't buy their actual romance.
I'm sorry, I did not actually make that connection.
Well, I'm glad that you brought that up then, because now I can very firmly hammer it home. Not to say that I wasn't moved by, like, when she trips and then opens her hand and it just says, I love you, even though, like, that you could have signed your name, too.
There was a lot of handwriting on that hand. There was not very much space. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, I thought for some reason I saw them writing towards their like wrist at some point, and I was like, "Whoa, they're really putting a lot on there." I was just like, "My goodness!" So,
but yeah, so that's just. I mean, like I said, the characters sold me on the romance. I think that once I figured out, I never doubted at a certain point that he loved her. I was deeply confused that she had ended up loving him. As I said, and so like his devastation and his sense of loss upon finding out that she was dead 3 years in the past really affected me. But after that point, when, you know, just getting into that again, I won't call it a caper, but the plot to save the village, it just kind of deadened it for me. And then after having to go through all of that narratively to get them both alive and both in Tokyo at the same time, I was very impatient for them to finally just see each other and talk, or not talk.
Sure.
If that was where the movie was going to go.
Yeah, I think it does. It is a little heavy handed towards the end, in that final kind of like sequence where they keep passing each other and you're just like, come on.
The steps, like you just got off a train and chased this girl and you're going to be like, maybe not.
Perfect. Perfect interlude into that song, though. I was just like, oh, holy shit. Okay, wow. Clearly the song was written for this movie. Like, like this is not a pop song. This is just, written specifically for this movie. Here you go. Here's the narrative.
They did the whole soundtrack. It's a group called the Red Wimps.
Ah, nice. I do want to mention, you know, kind of setting up the groundwork, the breadcrumbs, as it may. She mentions very early on that she wants to move to Tokyo and fall in love with a boy there. And so I think we're supposed to kind of be pushed that direction from the outset, and that she keeps body swapping with this guy.
She didn't say she wanted to fall in love with a boy. She said she wanted to be reborn as a boy in Tokyo. And so I was like, okay, some undercurrent of lesbianism, or at least transgenderism, which could then lead into her being attracted to women in somehow. I'm not great with terminology, but it really seemed like it was moving in that direction with her interest in that person whose name I can't remember.
Let's be honest though. The other thing is when she is reborn, she, you know, both of them are fairly attracted to each other, personally, or not personally, physically, right?
She's disgusted by his penis as well.
Wow.
Which my wife said apparently a legit thing.
Yeah, I've heard as much.
Yeah.
I can imagine so.
Can you imagine having nothing and then waking up and there's just this?
Yeah.
I mean, like, we don't have to get into my thoughts on male anatomy, but it's a nightmare. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And so if you don't have to deal with that and then suddenly you do, I'm surprised she was walking as well as she was in his body.
Yeah. I had
a woman ask, so how do you walk? And I was like, I don't understand the question. She's like, well, like men with a penis, how do you walk? Like, does it like crush your balls? And I was like, you know what? I am not drunk enough for this conversation yet.
That's an amazing question to ask you. I give credit to your friend.
She did not have a lot of social graces. And I could never come up with an answer for her, because I'm like, you know, it's where it's supposed to be. To not have that be a problem, I guess.
Yep.
Yeah.
It is funny how we've been on this earth for as long as we have. Yep. Somehow we've evolved to not crush our own ball sack.
I mean, we're not supposed to be standing upright, Bill. This is an incorrect posture for our skeletal structure and musculature. So it would not surprise me if...
No, that is not true. That is why our glutes are big.
That's why we're able to, but the reason why people have chronic back issues in their later years is because you're not supposed to be using your spine in that way.
No. It's because they sit too much, Brian. Our society sits way, 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 way too much.
I'm, you know what?
Cultures
we'll
all
look
across
this up,
the
and this will become a round table.
Sure. We were meant for locomotion. We were not meant to just sit, stand still, but we were meant for locomotion for sure.
Yeah, but like monkeys and apes use their hands in service of that locomotion.
Sure, but they also do not have the glute size that we do. That's why we stand upright. We have glutes.
Is it not possible that we have gotten the glute size, but that we have not yet fully evolved into a standing posture in terms of everything else? That our glutes, are stronger, faster, better, stronger than they should be for where we are right now?
No. We don't use our glutes. We don't fire them. We don't use them properly. We don't use our spinal structure correctly. We don't stand straight well.
Firing a glute is. But anyway, let's move on. Roundtable topic. How should people be walking? I literally can't remember where we were going with this.
That's fine.
We should probably wrap up soon.
Anyway. Yes. Need to go. I just want to say that I fully agree that the last 5 minutes or so is a big, huge whiff for me, and it almost kind of tumbled the film entirely. I think I was just so delighted by the pop song at the end that I was really just like, wow, this film just it keeps figuring out a way to just kind of reel me back in, because you're right, Brian. They're passing each other. They're going past each other, and you know each other are alive, and it's just like, what are you doing? Why are you playing this out?
There is literally that scene in the other movie, guys. I'm not even remotely joking.
Which other movie?
At 5 centimeters per second.
Oh, okay. Oh, that is weird.
Okay.
My thing is, shouldn't the other people in their lives remember, like, oh, hey, you acted crazy a bunch of days? Like, they seem to lose all evidence of what was going on. And his friend is like, can you believe this nonsense he's spouting about this girl? And it's like, well, he was crazy.
Also, the grandma apparently says that she dreams, too, and is aware.
That is an odd thread. and it goes back in history in a way. And
her mother might have, too.
So I don't know if y'all had read this, Michael, while you were kind of researching into this. I was made aware of this because of another podcast. Actually, it was Joanna.
Joanna,
she was mentioned Robinson. Sorry.
On which podcast?
On Gen Pop, they were talking about this, and she was mentioning how there's this kind of storyline, I guess, in Japanese culture, called the Red Strings, and it's about these kind of intertwining, jumping through history kind of narratives that follow these, I guess, literal like strings of threads and things like that. And so that's kind of loosely connects to that film in that way, because there's this beautiful montage of them actually making knots and making the string that Mitsuha ultimately gives the Taki, right?
They say twist, tangle, sometimes unravel, then connect again.
Yeah. And so it is interesting that they call it?
It was Musubi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think there's kind of a connection there that's kind of overarching, more than likely, about like where this kind of film is kind of generating from and stuff like that. So I unfortunately just now recalled it and would have definitely looked it up a little bit earlier had I had I known.
And that's one of those.
Or had I remembered. Damn concepts. It! Like I'm living in a your name situation where I'm like remembering things now. I'm like, oh, I should have looked that up.
Your name is Bill.
It's on Wiki. It's called Red String of Fate. Does okay. that help?
So what I was gonna say is that's one of those. This will be how I wrap up. That is one of those ideas and concepts that was introduced that was super interesting to me, and I was wondering how the movie was going to deal with that, and I was wondering how it would explore how he would be affected by seeing this girl who was dead forever. But the movie then does a dramatic tonal and narrative shift in order to instead change it into we just have to find each other again without remembering each other. And then they do. And then it's over. And maybe this is the Manchester by the Sea lover in me, but I think I would have been happier with this movie if she just stayed dead and he had to deal with that existentially.
The darkest timeline. Yeah.
Right. You know, I'm always going to go for the darkest timeline.
Sad. Bastards.
I know. Michael Snydell, any final thoughts before we wrap up?
I have to say I was, you know, after talking about this for, you know, almost an hour and a half, like, you know, I'm admiring this movie the more we talk about it. And I think it's trying ambitious things. And I'm definitely curious to see what's next this director.
It's definitely interesting film. There's things to talk about.
Yeah. It is probably too ambitious for its own good in many ways, but
weirdly enough, Bill, I think it's not ambitious enough. I think it gets too conventional in that third act.
Well, I think that's the reason that it's too ambitious is how do you end a film like that? Where do you end a film like that? And I think what he did was he was like, cool, I'm just going to go revert back to this thing I really like to explore. And, I've dabbled over here enough.
It's ambitious in its story. Like, I guess its tonal and narrative shift is a kind of ambition. But I think that, like, thematically, it loses a bit of its ambition when it, like, refuses to just stick with its choice. You know, it's like, oh, you know what would be really heartbreaking is if this girl was dead. And then... okay, but we still want them to be together, so how do we do that? Well, we'll turn it into like an 80s Spielberg knockoff.
Well, the weird thing is it could actually be an hour and 10-minute movie. Like, I could definitely see a cut of this that would be that short.
You just end it.
That would be a devastating
What you would do
movie.
Is you'd end it with him finding her name. You end it with him finding her name in that book, and then you cut out literally everything until it's like 5 years later, and he's telling that story about being obsessed with her town and wanting to be an architect to preserve memory. And then it's
over. I kind of love even the idea of ending on seeing her name in the book. And then that really jaunty pops up.
Okay, that's why you were laughing.
That's like my thought on every movie is better if it ends with The Power of Love by Huey Lewis in the News.
Yep.
Anyway, let's end this. Let's get out of here. So today's episode of Gorse was brought to you by Mubi, the streaming online cinema. For your free 30-day trial of Mubi, all you got to do is go to mubi.com/filmstage, and that entitles you to 30 days free of one of the most interesting streaming websites out there. It gives you 30 films at a time to select and look at and enjoy. You can download them to your mobile devices. Every day, one movie disappears and one movie is added. So it is a rotating cavalcade of films for you to enjoy. So again, that is mubi.com/filmstage for your free 30-day trial. So gentlemen, next time that we speak, we'll be talking about The Lost City of Z, and that should be up this weekend. Z, whatever. Oh, man. It does have a the at the beginning, though, Bill, right? That's the most important part for me.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, great. Yes. So, The Lost City of Z, or Z, that'll be coming out.
It's nearly 3 hours, so that'll be interesting how long our podcast will be.
Yes. Yes, it will be.
Boy.
Because we routinely get within spitting distance of the actual runtime of these movies.
We only got 20 more minutes for your name. We can do it.
Let's tell the fine people at home where you can be found between now and when we talk about The Lost City of ZZ. Bill Graham.
You can find me eating my oatmeal vigorously on Twitter at CableBFG. You can also find me writing about movies on The Film Stage and FreshFiction.tv.
All right, Michael Snydell.
You can find me on Twitter at Snydell, where I will be drinking regurgitated sake. And you can find my writing at The Film Stage and Pace Magazine.
All right, and you can find me.
I hate you so much right now, Brian.
On Twitter, at Brian J. Rowan, and writing on thefilmstage.com, my personal site, dearfilm.net. And I didn't make a joke, but it doesn't matter. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us, and tune in next time. Drive home, I called her mom from a payphone. I said I was the cops and your husband's in jail. The state looks down on sodomy. And that's just about the time she... Oh, you bastard.